Hey ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit. Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. Dagny & Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Our first guest is Stephen Zunis from Foreign Policy in Focus, joining us on the line from Berlin. How's it going?
Very good, thank you.
Well, good. I appreciate you joining us, and I know you're very busy, but I was hoping that you could tell us about Mali. You wrote the book on Mali, literally.
Well, actually, I wrote an article. I wrote the book on Western Sahara, which is a nearby country, but that's a separate issue.
Oh, I thought Mali was a big part of that whole thing.
Yeah. Western Sahara is a country that's occupied by Morocco.
You know what? I just did the Sarah Palin thing, right, where I confused West Sahara with Western Sahara.
Right, exactly. Yeah, a lot of people.
Boy, am I stupid.
But I have written a couple articles about Mali, and I'm happy to talk about that.
Okay, great. Well, so let's talk about Mali. First of all, it's a real funny-shaped country, isn't it? Where it sort of seems to me when I look at it, like it already ought to be a north and a south split anyway, no?
Yeah, in a sense, I mean, virtually all the borders you see in Africa, particularly that part of Africa, were drawn arbitrarily by European colonialists in the classic kind of divide and rule kind of issue, or no relation to natural geographic boundaries or ethnic groups or anything like that. And basically, they made them continually to be dependent and impoverished on the colonial power.
Right, yeah, if it has anything to do with the ethnic divisions, they deliberately cut the lines all screwy in order to divide and conquer, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, so now, would it be the case then that northern Mali, that's mostly where the Tuaregs live, or there's always Arabs and Berbers and all different kinds of people there, sand dunes, or what?
No, it's a mixture. It's what they call a Sahel, which is sort of where the more verdant parts of Africa gradually make their way into the Sahara Desert. There is some farming, but mostly grazing and herding. Timbuktu is located in that area, that famous trading center. And the Tuaregs are the predominant ethnic group of northern Mali, but also southern now Algeria and a lot of neighboring countries. They periodically had rebellion against the governments of other ethnicities that dominate them. Though Mali, interesting story. It looked for a time like it had been a big success because they had 20 years before the Arab Spring, they had one of these nonviolent people power revolutions. They didn't have Facebook or internet or any of this kind of stuff. And they were able to bring down the Traore dictatorship, despite massacring hundreds of people. Very impressive, nonviolent revolution. It gave Mali one of the most democratic countries in West Africa for the subsequent 20 years. The Tuaregs, they were able to make a deal where they could get some limited autonomy, and the Tuaregs ended up ending their sporadic armed struggle. In fact, there was this big ceremony where they put all their weapons in a big pile and set them on fire, and things looked really cool. But because of the war in Libya, the NATO intervention in Libya, these fellow Tuareg tribesmen who were up in parts of Libya got a hold of all these weapons, and they brought it down to their brethren in northern Mali and said, hey, we got all these weapons now. Maybe we can renew our armed struggle, especially since the democratically elected government in Mali was less popular than it was before. There was some corruption, other things, and so, but flush with all these weapons, thanks to NATO's intervention, they got a rebellion, ended up taking over the northern half of the country, and then that prompted a military coup in the southern part of Mali, the main part, at the capital, by a captain who'd been trained by the United States, another kind of unfortunately typical thing that seems to happen in that part of the world. And that, in turn, caused internal chaos. The army totally dropped the ball, and then these radical Islamist types, Al-Qaeda, types of people who identify with Al-Qaeda and that kind of extreme Salafi thing, they ended up taking over from the Tuaregs. And so now northern Mali is in the hands of these real nasty type people who are, you know, destroying these historic shrines and making everybody, you know, abide by their extreme version of Islam. And now the West is saying, oh dear, Al-Qaeda, we got to intervene now try to solve this this big threat. When, of course, as we've seen before in many other parts of the world, the whole mess got started with Western military intervention in the first place.
Right. Oh, man. So now, geez, there's so many different angles to go, but let's start with this Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Tell me everything about them, first of all, and then tell me about, elaborate, please, about them coming down and taking over. Seems like they didn't have any trouble pushing the Tuaregs right out of their way.
Basically, it was there. These folks also had gotten a hold of a lot of weapons, thanks to there's such chaos with the, unlike the nonviolent uprisings which overthrew Arab dictators, when there was at least some kind of orderly transition. In Libya, of course, it was total chaos. You have all these weapons going around North Africa, and these are places where you have bandits and smugglers, and it's kind of a lawless area anyway. And it was in this vacuum that you had these Al-Qaeda-related extremists. There's some debate about how much they're official Al-Qaeda and how much they are just sort of trying to imitate that kind of thing. But they don't have much popular support, but they do have guns. And this is an underpopulated area, so it doesn't take a whole lot of people with lots of guns to take over large areas. And a lot of the talk about Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb has been exaggerated as a means of justifying more Western military intervention. But the one place where they really have indeed seemed to have taken over is again this northern part of Mali. Now, part of the problem also, and this is too classic. I mean, it would be funny if the results weren't so tragic, is that they ended up overrunning these military. The United States has supplied the Malian army with these 92 land cruisers and the sophisticated satellite communication equipment and all that kind of stuff. Well, guess who controls all that now? The Al-Qaeda people overran these Malian military bases and got all this fancy new U.S. equipment, and now they got this stuff. And which helps them become even a more formidable military force.
Well, I'm reading about, and I had heard that these guys had their own kidnapping business up there in Algeria, that kind of thing. So maybe they had made a bunch of money, but Thomas Mountain was writing. I think he's just assuming, but it seems a pretty safe assumption, that when these Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb guys, as they're called, are driving around northern Mali in their brand new Toyota pickup trucks with their mounted machine guns in the back, that's the Saudis, man. Just like everywhere where the hobbies blow up anything, it's the Saudis financing it.
I haven't seen evidence that, there's direct Saudi government funding of these specific groups, but, it's a Saudi funding of these, these madrasas, these Islamist schools that teach this ultra conservative, Salafi version of Islam, which is not the way the Muslims of North Africa have traditionally been into it. The Muslims in the Sahel, that area, I mean, they're devoutly religious, but they're much more laid back in their religiosity. But because these countries are so poor and so corrupt, you end up in a situation where this is the only schooling available, and hey, the Saudis are paying for it, so great, let's send our kids to the school. And they get indoctrinated in this kind of extreme theology, which doesn't necessarily lead to terrorism, Al-Qaeda stuff type of behavior, but it certainly lays the theological foundation that makes that transition possible. Right. And indeed, that's part of what's been what's been going on there. It's a real tragedy, because especially for Mali, which for 20 years had been again one of the most stable democratic countries in the region.
Yep. Well, and you know what too, it's not like we're talking about of old guys with walking sticks left over from the 80s jihad against the Soviets. We're talking about the veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, who are the guys that we fought a war for in Libya, and the guys who are fighting a war for us right now, right now in Syria. And that's how these guys actually, have their act together at all is they've already, gone through that rite of passage. They're already veterans of one war, and they're on to spread the thing now further south into Africa.
And that's why a relatively small number of people have been able to take over all that land. It's not just the equipment that they were able to get a hold of in Libya and elsewhere, but because these are experienced fighters. These are Algerians. They're some Somalis. They're Nigerians. They're other foreigners who are veterans of the many of whom are veterans of the Iraq War, who got their training and got their radicalization. And just as the Soviet invasion occupation of Afghanistan radicalized this a generation of jihadists back in the 1980s, the United States, through its invasion occupation of Iraq, has radicalized a new generation of jihadists who are even more ruthless and even more extreme and better armed.
All right, now forgive me for oversimplifying this, but I ain't never been over there. I don't know. But it sure does seem like we fought a war in 2011. The United States fought a war against Gaddafi, whose number one attribute out of Western eyes ought to have been he was good at keeping Al-Qaeda down. And we fought a war for Al-Qaeda and for the veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq's war against the Americans in Libya. And then now... and to skip over, you talked about how the Tuaregs went home with the weapons, but now they've been pushed out of the way by these guys. Now they're the excuse to intervene there. The same thing sort of seems like it's happening in Syria, where for a year, you, me, and Pepe Escobar and everybody's been saying, geez, we're backing Al-Qaeda in Syria. And now all of a sudden Obama's going, you know what, you're right. Maybe we're going to have to begin to intervene there now since Al-Qaeda's there. And just ignoring the fact that he's the one who's been giving them all this money and weapons and, of course, working with the Saudis and the Qataris. They're just cutouts. That's no excuse.
Exactly. I mean, it is a little more complicated than that. But, yeah, basically you got it. And this should be a lesson, I mean? That, and it's a lesson that people like you and me have been saying for years, that even when it seems like an intervention is great for humanitarian reasons, responsibility to protect, all this, but there's a terrible, terrible dictator who's murdering his own people, even though that may be true, it always seems that when the West intervenes, it ends up just making things worse. In fact, what's interesting about Mali, the International Crisis Group, you've probably talked about them before, they're this international group of foreign policy elites from around the world, and their former head, Gareth Evans, is one of the folks who's been big intellectual architects around the responsibility to protect and all that kind of stuff, But even they have come out and said, intervening in Mali would be a really bad idea. but right now we're hearing the French president, Hollande, talking quite openly about intervening very, very soon. The U.S. and others have been trying to get ECOWAS, a coalition of West African countries, to have a military presence. You already have a small-scale military presence of Western-backed African states and the French and others. And with the French wanting an even bigger intervention, it raises a lot of questions. And, of course, remember, the French are, to this part of Africa, what the United States is to Latin America and what the Russians are to Eastern Europe. There's a history there, and people don't like it. And people are going to resist, even if they don't like Al-Qaeda.
Right. All right, now, the coup. I'm sorry for jumping around here so much, but you talked to me before about the former president. He was a former military man who took off as olive green and then stood for election a couple of times. I've heard different stories about just how credible those elections were and just how democratic he was, but certainly seemed to be, especially the way you tell it, certainly seemed to be the best in the region. And really trying, he seemed to, I guess you were under the impression, he really did want for there to be some kind of self-government and real regular elections and stuff like that. It wasn't just a put-on. Is that correct?
Yes, it was. I mean, yes, there was corruption, other problems, and but the thing was, his term was about to expire. He was not going to seek re-election. And a lot of criticism of him was legitimacy. It was legitimate. It wasn't like he was a dictator that was trying to hold on to power forever. He was on his way out anyway. And so this there's really no justification for this coup. And there's no evidence to suggest that the United States was behind the coup, especially the U.S. actually was did come out pretty strongly against it, at least verbally. But the very fact that he was U.S. trained, that his branch of the military had all this new U.S. equipment and stuff, certainly helped make the coup possible.
Mm-hmm. And now, so I don't know. I mean, if you're a colonel, this is just speculation, I guess, now, but if you're a colonel in the Mali military and you got some upcoming training exercises with the Americans and all this relationship, you don't need a wink and a nod from the CIA to tell you that it's okay to go ahead and do it?
I think, there's the internal situation was pretty complex, and France is actually still the major outside power in that country.
Right.
So,
obviously
can't rule something like that out, but again, I've seen no evidence to suggest that.
Sure. Okay. And then, but we have seen evidence, right, of the Joint Special Operations Command running around there because there was a truck flipped over and one of them died, right?
Oh yeah. Definitely. We're getting this. I mean, it's pretty small in overall numbers, but we are definitely getting elements to the U.S. military. There's a whole big thing to try to set up this Africa command, and there's a special concern about parts of West Africa, which not coincidentally are near these new promising oil deposits, mostly offshore, but there are some on the mainland as well. The U.S. has been quietly getting more and more involved militarily in West Africa, and there's been virtually no debate about this in Congress or much less in terms of the American public.
All right, now, so the news is that the rebels, as they're calling them, the al-Qaeda guys in northern Mali, have just taken a new city. I had it in front of me, but I don't know what the hell.
Kona.
But apparently they're doing better. And so this is, they're saying they, the French are on their way now. The UN's already authorized it, correct? And now, so I guess, assuming that's right in the setup to the question there, do they have any chance of going in there, finding these guys, cleaning them up real quick, and putting the government of the South back in charge in the North, that kind of thing? Or is this going to be, Iraq writ small or Somalia all over again?
Well, I mean, the original idea was that they'd be this process, which they figured would take months, where the French and Americans and others would help train, organize this ECOWAS force, that is this from this the group of West African nations, and in large part because they didn't want to have any North Americans or Europeans getting killed, and they also figured that having Africans do it instead of Europeans and North Americans would not provoke the same kind of nationalist reaction and that kind of thing. But because the AQM people, the al-Qaeda folks, are advancing more rapidly, in fact they are heading towards the capital, there is now talk of more direct intervention. My guess is that the French are not going to try to reconquer the North, but they are going to probably bring in air power and start bombing any kind of rebel columns. I assume there's going to be some kind of deal where I say, okay, we're going to draw this line in the sand, both literally and figuratively, and if the al-Qaeda groups get any further, there's going to be bombing, and there will probably be some ground forces to back that up if necessary. So basically the idea is going to be a holding action, but I have no question that there is going to be some kind of an attempt. It may not be till the fall, but there is going to be some kind of attempt in within the next year for some kind of Western-backed multinational force to reclaim the North from AQM.
All right, now, I guess technically I won't be officially wrong about this for 20 years, but my prediction in 2011 was America will be involved in Libya for 20 years, and that sooner or later, even if the special forces and their frontmen, local militia guys, and the airplanes can take out Gaddafi and take over Tripoli, that eventually, we're just a couple of suicide bombings away at some point, or some factional militia fight away from further intervention. And maybe, Obama's scared to do it, but I just wonder, was I completely wrong about that? Are the people of Libya working things out, and they're going to have themselves a great little democracy now while we're not paying attention? Or what the hell is going on in Libya now?
Well, there are two things. I mean, on the positive side is that, you know, they did have some reasonably free democratic elections, and some fair, you know, reasonably moderate elements ended up winning and forming a coalition and government. The bad news is that in a country of barely 6 million people, you have over 200,000 men under arms and militias that are not controlled by that government and are fighting each other for the spoils. I mean, every few weeks I'll read a story about these rival militias fighting for control of the Tripoli airport, you know, to take advantage of the taxes and that kind of thing. I remember reading a little piece about this hotel where this militia leader had been living there for months, hadn't paid his bill, and so they finally threw him out, and he came back a few hours later with his militia, and they shot up the place. I mean, this, and of course we saw what happened in Benghazi. So on the one hand, in terms of the official stuff, things have actually been going surprisingly well. But when you have, when people get the lesson that power comes from the barrel of the gun, you're going to be people who are going to try to assert their power that way. And that's the problem. I mean, the nonviolent revolutions, I mean, even though in places Egypt, you got the Muslim Brotherhood and the military still has some sway. I mean, a lot of problems in Egypt. At least you still have an active civil society, and you have people protesting in the streets, and there are people who are saying, okay, at least we got rid of Mubarak. We need to make things better, but let's keep on struggling. It may be a retracted struggle, but through massive nonviolent resistance and civil society mobilization and that kind of thing, we can create change ourselves. But if you overthrow a dictator through armed struggle, either you risk becoming another dictatorship, or you get this kind of chaos and these rival militias fighting each other and coups and this kind of craziness. And so I think that's and of course, when you have that kind of stuff going on in a country that's strategically located with a lot of oil, of course you're going to have the United States saying, oh gee, maybe we need to intervene or have a major military presence and that kind of thing. So I think your prediction on Libya may not be too far off.
Hey, you know, it's our proudest tradition going back to Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli.
Yeah, Stephen
Decatur, first military intervention in Libya was back in 1802. So we have a history. We've been doing for a while.
Hey, listen, thanks very much for your time on the show today. I appreciate it as always, Stephen.
Sure, my pleasure.
All right, everybody, that's the great Stephen Zunis from Foreign Policy and Focus. We'll be right back after this. Man, you need some Liberty stickers for the back of your truck. At LibertyStickers.com, they've got great state hate, like Pearl Harbor was an inside job. The Democrats want your guns. U.S. Army, die for Israel. Police brutality, not just for black people anymore. And government school, why you and your kids are so stupid. Check out these and 1,000 other great ones at LibertyStickers.com. And of course, they'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. The Emergency Committee for Israel. Brookings. Heritage. AIPAC. WINEP. JINSA. PNAC. CNAS. The AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/Scott Horton Show for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there. Hey, all, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by former hedge fund manager Mike Swanson, who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Wall Street Window is unique in that Mike shows people what he's really investing in and updates you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike thinks his positions are going to go up because of all the money the Federal Reserve is printing to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. And Mike's got a great new book coming out, so also keep your eye on writermichaelswanson.com for more details. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. They've got a brand new website with new and improved access to more than 20 years worth of essays promoting the cause of liberty. And FFF's writers, including Jacob Hornberger, Jim Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more, aren't just good. They're the best at opposing and discrediting our corrupt overlords in Washington and their warfare, welfare, regulatory police state. That's the Future Freedom Foundation's new and improved site at FFF.org.